You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We're going to be talking today about the Santa Fe Film Festival, first to Aaron Levantman, who programs the films at the festival, and then to filmmaker and actor Catherine Eaton, who's written and directed and stars in a terrific film called The Sounding. And we'll be talking to Wade Rathke, founder of the activist group Acorn. He's the subject of a very good documentary called The Organizer. There are many more films that you can check out by going to santafefilmfestival.com. I'm delighted now to welcome Aaron Levantman. He is lead programmer at the Santa Fe Film Festival, which started on Wednesday, February 7th, and runs through Sunday, the 11th of February. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
So the Santa Fe Film Festival continues. It's certainly been through its ups and downs over
Absolutely.
The last few years.
And it's now in a whole new incarnation.
Tell us about that.
Well, what we're doing this year is that we decided to make the festival part of Film Week. So Local 480 is joined forces with us, and we decided to do, in addition to the film festival, to have other events throughout the week that promoted not just events for film lovers, but also people that are in the film industry. And then we're also honoring luminaries in the New Mexico film industry on Sunday night with the New Mexico Hall of Fame Awards. And also because the legislative session's happening now, we wanted to do it this week so that people that were in town for that could also attend. So we have all kinds of workshops, panels, the Hall of Fame Awards. There's Shoot New Mexico, which is happening almost all week as well. And then there's the film festival. And we have over, I think, 30 or 40 film programs. And then within that are short film programs. So we probably have total close to 70 films.
So it's beginning to get back to its sort of former glory.
I'd like to think so. I mean, I've been in Santa Fe for about 14 years, and I've been involved with the film festival in various incarnations almost the whole time. And this is my fourth year doing programming for the festival, and it does feel like there's a lot of new energy now happening, in part because the film industry has seen so much growth here, and there are a lot more people that want to get involved in film. So we wanted to offer something for everyone and not just show films, but also really be able to educate people on what was happening in the industry.
Now, Local 480 is the union that comprises people who are in various parts of the film industry.
Exactly. A lot of technicians, a lot of people on crews, script supervisors, etc. So they're extremely active. They have an office, as you know, in Cerritos Road in Santa Fe. And so they're doing certain events around production and also on acting as well. There's going to be a SAG panel. So there's really so much happening as a result of us joining forces together that I think there's going to be a lot of excitement. There's also, I think, going to be a lot more people at the festival. We have filmmakers from all over the world that are attending, in some cases that are coming to show their 15-minute film just
nice.
Because they wanted to be part of the event and because everyone loves Santa Fe, so it's a great opportunity to come here. So I think we're going to be looking at a lot more people than we've had in past years.
Very interesting. Now, you as lead programmer have the enviable or unenviable position of looking at Lord knows how many submissions.
It's both. Yeah, so we get submissions from all over the world, including local films, and we have some great people that watch a lot of the submissions that have been with us for a while, and some people are new, and they make recommendations to me. And then I also look at the submissions to see what I think, things that really stand out, that look interesting, that I think would have an audience in Santa Fe, which is kind of the trick in doing programming, is it's not just my personal taste, it's what I think will play well here. And sometimes I show films that I might not have a personal interest in the subject matter, but I know there is an interest here. And I think the film is well made. And so I, you know, knew that people would be interested in seeing it. So it's really it's a combination of my own interest in what I think makes a good film and also what I think audiences will go see.
That's an interesting and delicate balancing act because you mm-hmm. also have to balance local, national, and international.
Yeah.
You have to balance long films and short films. You have to find films that are compatible with one another for a program.
Exactly. That's something I actually love to do is to sort of put the pieces together. And when I do a short program, I love to come up with interesting themes. Like we're doing a program of short films about dance because we were getting so many submissions that were using dance and movement to tell stories. So I wanted to do a program around that. But also pairing short films with the features, I really love to find good marriages. You know, we get, as I said, submissions from all over the place, and when I can find two films that fit well together that weren't submitted together, it's a kind of a cool thing, and the filmmakers really appreciate it.
Yeah, and maybe they make connections with one another.
Which has happened, and we've had a lot of great connections happen. You know, people that have met here, that have stayed in touch, that have worked together, and that's probably been one of the biggest pleasures I've had in being involved in this.
I've been covering the Santa Fe Film Festival since 2003.
Wow.
And it's so interesting to see how the world has changed since then. I still have a bunch of videotapes from
yeah.
the old days, and then some DVDs from the old days, and now everything is on screener, and the technology has changed in so many different
yeah.
ways in
yeah.
the film industry. How has that affected the independent filmmaking world?
Well, I think because a lot of technology is more accessible to people, and editing, you know, you can edit on your laptop, and that's all changed. I mean, when I was in film school, you know, back in the early 90s, it wasn't so accessible, and you were actually editing on these, you know, big platforms. Now you can actually do it easily yourself.
Does that mean there's more junk being made?
Oh, probably, yeah. I mean, I think there's more of everything. And also the internet has allowed more content to become available to people. It's sort of like blogging. I mean, it's like anyone can do something, and it's you can get it up there. In terms of getting your film seen in festivals and then theatrically and then through a large platform like Netflix, I think it's become a lot more competitive. Although I think, you know, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, they're opening the doors to new filmmakers and for these platforms to experiment with different kinds of content also. So that can be exciting.
Are there any highlights for you? And I know that, I mean, you've chosen a whole bunch of films and you don't want to say, oh, this one's bad, but, you know, but are there any particular kind of surprises and delights and gems for you that you want to point out to people?
Yeah, well, I wanted just to talk about a couple of people that are coming to the festival, one in particular who directed a film that we're showing, Melanie Mayron, who is an actress who I grew up watching her movies in the 70s. She worked with Paul Mazursky, Costa Gavras, all these great 70s directors, and was in movies like Car Wash and Gable and Lombard, but then also was in more serious films like Missing and Playing for Time. And she directed a movie called Snapshots that is with Piper Laurie and Brooke Adams, two actresses I've always liked. And it addresses issues around women and aging and past histories and secrets and family. It's a great melodrama. And Melanie has been directing a lot for television in the last 20 years. Shows like Grace and Frankie and Graves, which is shot here. Other HBO shows like In Treatment. So she's become a very seasoned director herself and has made that transition. So I wanted the opportunity to actually have the audience hear about her life and career. So I'm actually going to do a sit-down one-on-one with her for about 90 minutes where I'm going to just ask her questions about her life and career, and the audience is going to have an opportunity to ask questions. And then we're going to show her film Snapshots that she directed, and then there'll be a Q&A with the writer-producer Jan Koren and other people that worked on the film. So that I'm really excited about. And then I actually love our short programs. I love short movies. We're doing an international shorts program. And we have different countries represented, such as Belize, Korea, Ireland. And they're different stories that are very picturesque, very moving, and in some cases very sexy and poignant. So you get to see how films in different countries are made and the difference in narrative structure and content. So that I'm really looking forward to.
One of the beautiful things about short films is that they are fundamentally non-commercial compared to feature
right.
films, because the investment in them is less, and so the artistic quality of them doesn't get compromised in the way that feature films sometimes do.
Right, and you're forced to tell a story in a short amount of time. I mean, some of the films we're showing are 3 minutes, some are 25 minutes or 40 minutes, so you're right, they're not commercials. They're true labors of love. That's why I love the opportunity to show them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where you can see these movies, are in festivals. In some cases, the internet, but not always.
If people want to find out more, are you distributing schedules around
yep.
town?
They're actually available now. You can pick them up at the different venues where the theaters are showing films, which is CCA, The Screen, and the Jean Cocteau. They're also available at the Hotel Santa Fe, which is our headquarters. And you can go in and they'll tell you where our office is, which is in the library of the hotel, and we'll have programs there. You can also just go to our website, santafefilmfestival.com, and we have the entire schedule on there. And you can also click on the individual films to find out more about what the films are about and go to their websites and purchase tickets in advance.
Aaron Levantman is the lead programmer at the Santa Fe Film Festival. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to welcome Catherine Eaton. She is director and co-writer and lead actress in the film The Sounding, which is part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be chatting with you, and I'm very, very excited to have the film screen in Santa Fe.
It's such an interesting film, and I was trying to think, I've never quite seen anything like it before, and I was trying to think, like, what genre would you put this in? Not that everything has to be in a genre, but what I came up with was like sci-fi for Shakespeare nerds.
I would totally take that. Yeah, that's great. We often say it's a mystery, or sometimes people have called it a psychological thriller. I think thriller is a bit strong, but it's a mystery drama. But I like sci-fi is interesting. It's definitely for Shakespeare nerds. It's also for people who love Oliver Sacks and, you know, are curious about the mind and the way the mind works, and people who are big fans of TED Talks, we've found have been a great part of our audience. And then we've actually had this amazing experience in taking the film around the country of finding just how diverse the audience is for the film. Those were all kind of the people that we knew would love it. And then this amazing thing has happened where there have been all kinds of people who've seen it as sort of the individuals fight against the system. And then that's appealed to a lot of different people from a lot of different demographics. So it's been exciting, but I'll take any definition that gets people to come and see it.
Well, there is a little reference to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in it.
There is. Yep. There absolutely is. There had to be. I think any film that has any part of the film taking place in a psychiatric center sort of has to give a little nod to that.
So without giving too much away about the film, and with narrative films, you don't want to just like tell the whole plot, but it's basically about a woman played by you who has, for whatever reason, chosen to be silent. She doesn't speak. It's not entirely clear, or maybe I missed it, how long she hasn't been speaking, but she's a grown woman. And when her grandfather and caretaker dies, she starts to speak, but only in Shakespeare's language, not her own sentences. Every single line is from William Shakespeare. How did this idea come to you?
That's a great summation of the film as a sort of non-spoiler effect. But the way that it happened was, I'm classically trained as an actor, and I came up as an actor, and I did a lot of Shakespeare. And I was in Los Angeles, and I got a phone call that my mom had fallen and slipped on the ice in Vermont and broken her ankle, and that someone needed to go home and help her out. And my brother was married and my sister was in college, so I was the natural choice. And I went to Vermont in the middle of winter thinking that it would be a couple of weeks, and it ended up being much, much longer. And 6 months later, I was still there. And I was working on a farm to pay the medical bills, because there's not enough acting work out there, or at the time there wasn't any way to sort of make a full-time career. And I came home one night and I was in my overalls and I was covered in mud and muck from the farm. And I brought my mom out and gave her dinner and helped her to bed. And I just felt this overwhelming need to be surrounded by the language that I loved. And I pulled out my complete works of Shakespeare and I started tearing the pages out of the pieces I loved and hanging them on the walls. And I like to say that by the morning the house was covered, and it looked like that scene in A Beautiful Mind when Professor Nash has made all these kind of crazy connections and there's twine and circling and all sorts of things. But I did sort of see patterns emerge from the language that I had known were there, but I had never thought about what would happen if these were all coming out of one person's mouth, and why would somebody choose that? And why did I, as a contemporary woman today, need that language so badly in that moment? And so that's how Liv, the character of Liv, was born. Was she came out of my own need for poetry and language and beauty, and Shakespeare's language in particular in my case. And I wanted to know what would happen if someone chose that and why they would do that.
The choosing to be silent, I kind of did a Google search, and there are things like selective mutism and voluntary mutism, but mm-hmm. what the character in the film, Liv, Olivia, has or acts out, is it something that kind of exists in the medical psychiatric literature?
It's a good question. I love for audiences to sort of draw their own conclusions about this. What I will say is that we did a lot of research. We had a lot of psychiatrists who are working in state-run hospitals and private psychiatrists and neurologists look at the scripts. And actually, we had certain advisors that helped us to be able to do psychiatric center visits. And they also analyzed Liv as a patient, in a sense. And through that process, there were a lot of different sort of diagnoses and approaches to what would happen to her, to how she might be treated if she did have to go through the medical system, and possible causes of what's causing it. But the film intentionally lets us find our own way towards that path.
I think another thing that the film does so well, and that is so important, I mean, so much of what goes on in psychiatric hospitals is completely unknown, even to the families of the patients, much less the general public. And for whatever reasons, many or all of them well-intentioned, the system can be just cruel, it can be stifling, it can be antithetical to individual expression, creativity, love, and all the things that make us human, and therefore can be really dehumanizing. And I think one of the things the film does is explore that without having anybody really be the bad guy.
Thank you. I think that's great. It was really, really important to me. There was no intention to villainize anybody in this film. And that's part of the reason that we had advisors, you know, that were actual practitioners in the mental health industry advising on the film, because I kept checking in with them and saying, is this accurate? Is this realistic? Is this a commentary, or are we telling the story? Because what I wanted to do was tell the story. This was not a project that I was using to comment on anything. It was about telling this one woman's story and her own journey. And some people don't see the film as being about mental health at all, actually, even though a good portion of it explores the question of the mind. There are people who see this as a film about, like I was saying, an individual against the system overall. Some people see this as about a woman's path through the world. And a lot of people see it as a film that's about personal authenticity. And what does it mean to choose a path for yourself and then decide that you're going to stick to that path? And at what point does it continue to be worth it? Are there places where one should compromise? That's often the question that audiences come out of this film with, or, you know, they often are sort of vehemently arguing about whether Liv should or should not compromise at various points in the film. And I always find that very, very interesting.
Well, in that sense, it reminded me of Antigone.
Oh, cool. Wow. Yeah, that's a lofty comparison. Thank you. I'll go down with the great Greeks.
Yeah, and that more modern French version of Antigone, which we had to read in high school. And it was very striking to me. I mean, this woman basically makes this sacrifice. Her brother had been killed in war, and she wants to and insists on giving him a burial, even though to do so would be to basically compromise her own life, her own freedom, her own everything, you know, mm-hmm. be giving it all up. And I mean, I remember being like a ninth grader and reading that and going, come on, Antigone, just make a compromise. You know, he's already dead.
You know,
but she doesn't. And I think that was my own introduction in life to what not compromising on principle looks like. So that's why I was thinking about it when I was watching your film, because this woman, there's something inside of her that can't make that compromise. And again, we don't want to give away too much of the film. Ladies and gentlemen, go out and see it, because then you'll know what we're talking about. But it's a kind of character that I would say is probably a small minority of people, and therefore really interesting, because sometimes those people are extraordinarily creative or extraordinarily strong in ways that the rest of us aren't.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it. I love that. It's funny because I actually find her incredibly relatable. Obviously, I played her and I co-wrote the script and I directed the film. So I've lived with her for a very long time. But for me, a lot of these, you know, her choice of choosing Shakespeare's language, that's a stand-in in many ways. That can be a stand-in for any of us, you know, speaking our truth ultimately. And the desire to be able to continue to speak your truth, no matter what the odds are, I think is something we all have. Whatever we believe, whatever our background is, education, religion, political beliefs, whatever it is, I think most individuals, because I'll say at least in America, because we are culturally a country of individualism, there's a real desire to be able to speak your truth and to have it be witnessed and heard. And so there's something really, I think, that appeals to people about Liv in that regard. That's something that she's really fighting to do. There's a real sense of sort of rebellion in the film that I think is appealing to people, you know, and whether that's because of the timing, you know, the sort of zeitgeist of what's happening in our world, or whether it's just a case of that this is something that's, you know, that people love to see someone stand up and sort of stand on their own two feet is I think something that people have found really appealing. So in that way, I think she is relatable, but I do hear what you're saying. She's chosen a unique path by which to do that.
You started out talking about how you had this experience of ripping pages out of the complete works of Shakespeare, which even when the character does this in the film, I'm like, you're destroying the book. But this came from real life and you were doing it yourself. Talk about the path from that moment and kind of the emotional realization that came with that moment to the making of an actual film.
Basically, there was this sort of War and Peace version of this character on the page in a play form, this sort of almost one-woman show that I kind of wove out of these pieces of Shakespeare. And then I put it in a drawer, and my mom got better, thankfully, and I went to New York to continue my career as an actor. And there I met my romantic partner, who is also the co-screenwriter on this film and a producer on it, Brian Delaney. And he asked me if I'd ever written before, and I told him about this one-woman show, and he looked at it and started working on it dramaturgically. And we built it up into this play, and I ended up doing it at Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall, and I took it across Europe. And I brought it all the way back to New York. A friend of mine was the artistic director of the Roger Smith Hotel in New York on 47th and Lexington. And they had a glassed-in storefront space that they did performance art in. And you perform inside the glass and the sound is piped out onto the street. And he'd never done a narrative piece there. And he asked me to do this play there about this woman trapped in the observation room of a psychiatric center, which is, you know, a very, very small part of the film, but was the entire play at the time. And so I said no first because I thought, I don't want to perform in a glass box like some sort of monkey in a cage. And he convinced me, and I'm so grateful that he did. And so the lights would go down in New York, it would become dark, and this white glass box would glow, and inside would be this woman in this gown scrawled in Shakespeare, spouting Shakespeare's language. And it became this kind of cult hit. And the sidewalks became packed, and they became a fire hazard. The police had to come. Cars were stopping at the intersection and not moving forward. Homeless people came, and they would bang on the glass saying, "I'll get you out," which was amazing. Stockbrokers were standing in the rain under the phone booth awnings, videotaping and making phone calls. And every night this man came and he wore a tuxedo and he stood front and center in the glass watching the show. And because he had a peach-colored Financial Times under his arm every night, the guys in the back jokingly called him the financier. And they would ask me, "Did the financier come tonight? Did the financier come tonight?" And the last night of the play, he waited for me afterwards and said, "I would like to turn your play into a feature film." And he became the first investor in the film and started the journey and process of making this piece that's very personal to me into this incredibly beautiful film that I'm so proud of, that so many people worked on, that involved so much extraordinary talent and people who had much, much, much more experience than I did and changed my life. And now I direct and write and act.
So this was really your first experience as director, and I guess you stepped into that role almost reluctantly.
Yes, yeah, I did in some ways. I knew once we knew that it was going to become a film, I did not intend to direct it. I knew that I needed to play Liv, that I had written the part for myself, and I didn't know that I could do both. I didn't know if I could do both. There were some examples. There are many more examples today, of course, but it's a fast growing industry of director actors, but they're, you know, it's new enough. And I had never directed a film before. So we were anticipating bringing on a director, and we did a lot of interviews in LA and so forth with amazing directors, some of whom became my mentors on this project, actually. And every time we had to go into one of the big agencies with my wonderful producers, I tried to study more about directing so I could describe better and better the kind of director that we needed for this film. And every director we met kind of had their own lens, but the producers weren't satisfied with. And so eventually they approached me and said, "We'd like you to direct the film." And I said no. And then I went home and I spoke with my partner, Brian, and he said, I think you should really reconsider that, because I don't think anybody's going to write you this golden ticket again. And so I said, okay, let me direct a short film. Let me act and direct a short film and see if I have a point of view, if I like directing, what my aesthetic is, if I can do both, if one of them is compromised. And I did a film that involved the same character that's in the feature. I did a short version, one scene, and it was the most creatively rewarding thing I had ever done in my life. So now there's no going back.
Do you know what's next for you? Or are you pretty much focusing on bringing this film around the country and so on?
It's both. I mean, I still have a lot of attention on the sounding, and we've had an incredible festival run so far. And I'm so grateful to be playing at Santa Fe Film Festival. And we're starting our international festivals now, and that's just all extraordinary. And the film will be distributed in 2018, which is also very exciting. But I also have a television show. I have a couple of different television projects, and one of them is in development right now, and I love it. The exciting thing about TV is you can write, direct, and act for television, but instead of it being just this hour and a half or 2 hours on screen, it's 10 hours or 12 hours over the course of a season. So it's kind of the novel. It's the comparison of the novel to the short story in some ways. But television now, because the quality is so high, has become like the novel. And the film has become in some ways like the short story. So I'll definitely direct films again in the future. But right now I'm trying to focus my attention on getting this television show up and running. So it's called On the Outs, by the way.
Excellent. We'll keep our eyes out for it. Catherine Eaton is director, co-writer, and lead actor in the film The Sounding, which is part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. It screens on Sunday, the 11th of February at 4:45 at The Screen on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm so grateful, Mary Charlotte. And if people want to find out more about the film in general, they can go to thesoundingfilm.com.
Thesoundingfilm.com. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
We turn now to Wade Rathke, the subject of a documentary called The Organizer, which is being presented at The Screen on Saturday, February 10th at 11 in the morning. Wade Rathke co-founded the organization ACORN, which stands for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. It was a progressive organization that fought for low-income and disenfranchised people and had over 1,000 chapters across the country and abroad. In 2010, after 4 decades of work, it disbanded after a controversy in which right-wing activists released videos that appeared to show ACORN staff encouraging criminal behavior. The videos were made by James O'Keefe, who has made other videos that attempted to attack Planned Parenthood, NPR, The Washington Post, and many others. The anti-ACORN videos were found to be falsified, and ACORN was cleared of all wrongdoing, but the scandal, groundless though it was, bankrupted the organization. But Wade Rathke has continued to organize worldwide and is currently working with activists in countries on almost every continent. The work is funded in part by his New Orleans business, the Fair Grinds Coffee House. Welcome, Wade Rathke. Welcome, Wade Rathke.
Glad to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So you are the founder of this very famous organization called ACORN. You were a natural organizer always and a natural builder of organizations. What led you, a middle class, young at the time, white man, when you founded ACORN in 1970, to organize around the whole issue of inequality, income inequality?
Well, I mean, it actually was a strange time compared to even these days. It was the late 1960s, and it was a time of great change. You had to make up your mind if you were, so to speak, part of the solution or part of the problem. And whether it's because of my travels or the fact that I'd spent time with my mother living in Mississippi, and our class at my high school was the first public high school to be integrated in New Orleans when I was here, or being an outsider, it's hard to say, but I had a burning fire of anger about what I saw as inequality in our society, and was sort of desperate to find a way I could contribute and make a difference.
It seems to me sometimes that we're more divided than ever along racial lines. ACORN comprised people of all different races. Did you see racial divisions or tensions within ACORN? And if so, how did you overcome those divisions that were everywhere and still are in our society and in our history?
We focused on issues that people democratically agreed that they wanted to go after and that they saw as part of either longstanding grievances or part of their self-interest or just what they thought would improve their communities. And frankly, low and moderate income people were very proud of what they saw as their ability to work with a diverse set of other ethnicities and races. That's not to say there weren't rough edges dragging sometimes. We were organizing in the real world, and some of these communities were dealing with issues like blockbusting, which was an attempt to forcibly panic whites to leave certain neighborhoods and for African Americans to come in. So we confronted racial issues directly. They were discussed in leadership training and in the course of regular meetings. And I think people just did their best to focus on the positive. That's not to say there were never problems. There were certainly issues where people had to learn more sensitivity and respect for each other, but that's the nature of building an organization.
You focused on housing, school lunches, voter registration, on issues specific to the areas where you were working, and it became an ever larger organization. And often you were very successful. What do you think were the keys to that success?
Well, the first is we never quit.
Yeah.
No matter what the odds were, once we tackled a campaign, whether it was predatory lending or discrimination in housing loans or, you know, the many campaigns we ran around living wages and other things, just basic loose dogs, sewer, stop sign, you know, things in the neighborhood, we were dogs on a bone. There's an old saying in the South, at least in the West, that you may beat me, but you got to whip us first. Well, I mean, we hung in there until we either got an agreement or won something. I think that gained respect in the communities, and it was the kind of culture that low and moderate income families understood. They knew nothing was going to become easy. They knew it was not going to be a sliding easy, you know, path to get there, but they were always willing to put their shoulder to the wheel and their feet in the street and their butts on the buses and do whatever was necessary to win.
Sometimes when I talk to people who are progressives or the so-called left, I notice that they, and I don't know, I'd love to hear your perception of this, but that they focus more on ideology than on power. And you understood and understand the nature of power very deeply. What kind of power was Acorn trying to achieve, and how did it go about that?
We were a different kind of an organization in terms of community organizations. If we could roll the clock back, this was Acorn began sort of in the wake of the War on Poverty, Office of Economic Opportunity, Model Cities programs that were supposed to help rebuild urban areas that focused on maximum participation, but increasingly it was clear that participation without power really was meaningless. It didn't add up to people. And the notion simply that there were people that had more influence or riches and we had more numbers and that somehow balanced the scale didn't really resonate in terms of how people understood power. And we were not a tax-exempt organization. If the members were fighting City Hall or the governor's office, and it took getting involved, doing voter registration, getting people out to vote, even endorsing candidates in order to get their voices heard, there were no barriers within Acorn's activity that said, no, you can't do that. There's a funder that says, you know, or anything along those lines. So we responded organizationally to how people understood power.
Did you run candidates, for example, for local offices?
Our members, the motto of the organization was the people shall rule. And as early as 2003, Acorn members ran for office in nonpartisan elections, both at the county level in Arkansas, as well as for school boards and city directors or city council people. And that was true not only in the early history of the organization, but it set a pattern that was repeated, whether we were in Connecticut or New Mexico or Michigan or Arizona, where members saw the opportunity to step up, they did. And increasingly, they also tried to hold candidates' feet to the fire in terms of if they were running, what were their positions around issues the organization had articulated.
What were some of the kinds of pushback that you got along the way over the decades that you were organizing in the U.S.?
This is going to be a long interview, Mary Charlotte. In the very beginning, as you've already raised, I mean, we were a multiracial organization in Arkansas. You know, we may have worn cowboy boots, but we were more south than west in many of the areas. And the very first organizing committees were broken up by the Ku Klux Klan back in those days. The legislature was outraged when we first started organizing, wanted to pass resolutions to get membership lists. So it was one of those things where the conservatives knew that they needed to oppose what we were doing, and liberals always just said, you know, we support what you're trying to do, we just don't like your tactics. So we were an organization that used conflict and direct action as part of the model. Our members were not shy about demanding change when they thought that was the most appropriate. They wouldn't, you know, start at the top. I mean, they would send the letters and pass the petitions, but if those things didn't work, they were willing to rally, demonstrate, sit in, do whatever, picket, do whatever they needed to do to get attention and try to make change.
When you look at income inequality today, when you look at the surveillance state, when you look at the militarization of the civilian police, so many things, money and politics, it looks like everything that you and so many others were fighting for has gotten worse. How do you understand that? I mean, I think in some ways the kind of war of the minds has been won, but the actual war, or so many battles in it, have been lost.
It's a tragic thing, and I'm not going to tell you that your observation is wrong. I mean, you take one small area. We helped, and a major part of ACORN's work over the years was trying to increase the level of home ownership for lower income African American Latino families. And over a 30-year odd period, because from the passage of Community Reinvestment Act until 2008, we had huge success in doing that. Forced banks to put billions of dollars in. By some count, agreements we negotiated directly led to 6 million lower income people getting home ownership. In the last 10 years, we've watched all of those increases that hit record highs of home ownership for African-American, lower-income, and Latino families totally wiped out. We're back where we were. Now, do I think everything is exactly the way it was? I mean, there is capacity. There's an understanding that this is a contentious situation. But without a doubt, we're fighting. Our constituency is right now, if the pendulum is swung, it's swung against us currently. And it's a huge call for more activity and an organization now in the United States to try to have these voices heard once again.
Yeah, I mean, the film points out something that I didn't know quite so starkly, that the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the United States was from predatory lending. And billions of dollars in home equity was basically taken from low-income, moderate-income people and transferred to the bankers. What now? Like, just get back to it, bang away until we make gains again? Different strategy? What are you thinking when you look at the current situation?
We always need different strategies. If we're not learning and adapting every day, people on the other side are going to eat our lunch. So on that part, I can't say that we can just do the same thing we did in the past and hope that it wins. There's an old saying that, you know, the sign of insanity is, you know, continuing to do the same thing over and over again, no matter what.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's no question that we need organizational responses that move mass numbers of people once again to be able to call the question that we need in this country a society and an economy that doesn't just benefit the rich and the corporate elite, that does, in fact, deliver benefits. And I'll give you an example, Mary Charlotte. The last 10 years, we've seen rents go up for all levels of families by 15% in cities throughout the country. That's the average, whether it's Albuquerque, Santa Fe, or New Orleans and Little Rock. But at the same time, the average income for families has actually gone down in that same period. So, I mean, for all this sort of talk of the, you know, the booming economy and the recovery since 2008, there's no trickle down. It's trickling up, and it's more like a roaring flood going forward, while costs, particularly in situations like rent or gas or food, they aren't going down. We're in a bind.
I mean, the thing that I kept thinking about, and I think that so many of us are thinking about a lot, people who are not in the 1%, is that the United States holds itself up as a bright, shining democracy, but in so many ways is really hostile to democracy and the kind of work that you've done. I mean, you guys weren't asking to take over the country. You were basically asking for some fundamental rights like fair housing and keeping up with the rate of inflation and school lunches and the
voter
right to vote.
For goodness sakes. Exactly right.
Yeah.
And these issues have now all become contentious, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, how do you understand that? I mean, that's the dark side of the U.S., that hostility to democracy. How do you understand it?
I think it's a matter of opposing it. I mean, understanding it is the kind of clear analysis you have. I mean, you can't, for example, keep restricting people's access to voting, which is happening in state after state and is part of a very concerted right-wing conservative attack on basic democratic rights. I mean, if we can't at least allow people to vote, how do we even pretend we are a democratic society? I mean, I think that's increasingly coming into question. And currently, it's a question whether or not we're even a society of laws, or, you know, what kind of checks and balances exist. And that's across, permeates all of political discourse and exchange right now. Meanwhile, who cares about what low and moderate income families are suffering and whether or not they have a voice, and whether it's Citizens United and the unparalleled investment of finances from the rich into the political system. We're just having those of us who live and breathe in the constituency of lower income working families are having a very difficult time getting our voices heard. And if they're heard, they're not heeded.
You refer in the film to the Trump campaign as a kind of fake populism. A lot of those voters seem like they could have just as easily been really taken by a message like Acorns that focused on people getting their fair share of the country's wealth. But that's not happening. Why not, do you think?
Well, your observation, once again, is spot on. I mean, what I said a year ago is that broke my heart looking at the numbers state to state is that in many cases, these were exactly who would have been Acorn members had Acorn still been as active in the United States as it was up until 2008, 2009. So, I mean, people feel dispossessed. People are alienated. And when people are in that situation, they're going to vote their anger, not based on some rational calculations of what's better or worse. I mean, people clearly wanted to turn the bums out, turn the thing over, see if they could get something to come their way that in many of these communities seem to be lost and uncared for. And President Trump, give the devil his due, knew how to respond to that in a way that the alternatives weren't resonating in that same way. Now, what have we learned is part of the question that I've got to ask. I mean, we can't be distracted by the sideshow in the White House and the West Wing. We've got to look at what lessons there are to learn, what the alternatives are, how is change really made, are there real responses to deeply held feelings that unite people across our constituency. And I'm not sure if that's happening yet, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what kind of organizing do you see going on right now? Who's doing it? Are you not seeing it?
There are certainly a lot of different efforts, but they are a little bit more disjointed. I mean, one could argue that part of the problem Acorn had is that we flew a little too close to the sun, perhaps. I mean, clearly, we were unifying groups of people and constituency issues nationally. So there are some very vibrant local projects, but part of the impact of the concerted destruction of ACORN in the United States is it chilled, it retarded some of these efforts. And there's a real tentativeness in community-based and even labor-based activities to quite engage in things like voter registration or in some of the sort of projects that were what we felt our membership was mandating ACORN be involved in. So I think there's still some uncertainty at how to respond, even if it's a situation where the issues and outcomes are so stark that they would seem in most cases to demand a response as they do now.
What kinds of structural changes do you think that we'd have to see in the United States to have a more genuine power sharing, wealth sharing, representation of citizens? And do you see other countries that are doing that better than we are, other democracies?
ACORN International now works in more than 15 countries, and we work in both in Latin America, in several countries in Africa, in India, as well as some EU countries, Italy, France, and certainly in the United Kingdom, both England and Scotland. Some of these issues are universal. I mean, what we're seeing, for example, now in terms of tenants' issues and the ability to find affordable housing is as huge an issue as in Europe and in the UK as it is increasingly here in the United States, which is part of why, if you saw the film at the end, ACORN Home Savers campaign is launched in 8 or 9 cities in the United States to try to address that kind of problem. But democracy is under attack pretty much everywhere, whether it's Brexit or, you know, the Trump phenomena or so many other things that we see, whether it's Brazil or Mexico or increasing levels of autocracy in so many countries, Poland, I mean, Italy, I could go on and on. These are not friendly times to people trying to make sure that there's equity and real common good projects that benefit everybody. And this sort of level of economic inequality is global. It's not just the U.S. So, you know, I don't want to sound like Debbie Downer. Obviously, I still believe as long as we're organizing and as we're moving forward, then we have a chance to turn this around. But the gap's getting larger, not narrower, and I worry about that. I mean, the capacity of unions are being crippled. There's a vacuum in many communities in terms of community organizations now. These are times that challenge all of us to do everything we can.
At the heart of it, there's a really important disconnect, I think, which is that in order for a democracy to function, its citizens do really have to have some basic level of comfort and functionality in their lives. I mean, if they can't afford anything, then companies can't sell them anything. If they get into debt crises, that cripples the economy, not just them, eventually when everybody goes bankrupt. And so it seems like we would have to just like, it's like a math problem, get to a point where the numbers collapse and it's actually in the interest of the people who are continually trying to consolidate power to start sharing again.
One would think so, but I mean, your analysis is once again accurate. I mean, if people are only looking at short-term advantage and transactional politics and economics and not transformative issues and what long-term consequences, that's how you have the sort of yawning gap we have in terms of income and rights, frankly. I mean, we're not just talking about inequality anymore. Under the current administration, we're talking about an aggressive declared war on the poor, on anyone who has less money, middle income on down, you know, whether it's denying Medicaid benefits, it's, denying food stamps, instituting work requirements, getting rid of affordable care. I mean, there is just no heart to it. So, yeah, frankly, these are all short term. They're, you know, appealing to a base that's writing the checks for political campaigns. It's not at all thinking about what the majority of people in this country need and demand. And until we're willing to sort of roll up our sleeves and do the work to put that majority in motion and so that it's willing to contend for power, we're going to be taking a real beating.
What was the role of your relations with the media when you were running Acorn? Was it important, I mean, not only just to do the organizing, but to tell the story and get those stories out? And what do you see the media landscape looking like right now?
You know, one has to be self-critical. Clearly, we didn't do as good a job at telling our story within the media as we might should have. We didn't have the advantage of access to the inexpensive media that, say, social media provides now, and that increasingly websites were providing, you know, a decade ago. So we did our best. We organized radio stations. We built from the ground several non-commercial stations so that they had the voice of the people, is what we call the stations in Dallas and Tampa and Little Rock. And now we have one in Little Rock as well. So it's not that we were unmindful that we needed to project our members' voice as much as possible, but the big story of celebrity personalities and whatever was never the Acorn story. This was a grassroots organization. Leaders were elected, staff, people like myself were behind the leaders. They led, we followed. So it was not about building the kind of personalities and narrative that is, frankly, easier for media to pick up and run with. So that when Acorn was attacked after I left, it was difficult for the organization to defend itself. It was seen as the movie sort of, you know, refers to it a couple of times, a ragtag, low-income people's group. And a lot of what we might have thought were our friends and allies deserted us fairly quickly once we were attacked.
When you talk about that, the kind of leadership that you had, that kind of local leadership, and you stayed out of the limelight and you really helped local leaders elevate themselves, there's, like, to me, there's a beauty in that. There's a humility and a sense of service to one's community as opposed to drawing attention to oneself and that kind of thing. Not, I don't just mean for you, but like the people who were leaders in these various communities in Arkansas at the beginning and then spreading out across the country. And it's sad to me that that is the least attention-getting thing and the least praised thing when it's, I mean, it's part of everybody's spiritual tradition that...
And it's fundamental to a democratic process, as we've pointed out several times. I mean, without having people who rise from, you know, from their kitchen table and, you know, leave the house and go out into the public forum and make their voice and demands heard, we don't have a democracy.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be a fundamental part of it. And it was fundamental for us. I mean, staff people were not members. This was a membership organization, not a public interest organization. Lower income families, they all paid dues, and we worked for that organization. So elected leadership was out front. And, you know, the wonderful thing you've seen watching the movie, and I hope other people take the advantage in Santa Fe of going to the festival and seeing it, is that the best thing was watching some of the leaders and some of the archival footage. I've now watched the movie several times over the last week when I was in Massachusetts with various groups. And, you know, you can't listen to Maude Hurd or Mildred Brown or Beulah Bostry or Vanessa Gehringer or Lanny Roy, any of those folks, without saying, wow, I mean, who are those people? Where did they come from? Where are they now? So, I mean, yeah, they sell the movie, you know, a little bit wrapped around the work I did, but you know, you can't see the movie without just being so impressed at what the strength and vision of the leadership of Acorn was. That's a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. What was it like for you having a movie made about your work?
It was very uncomfortable, frankly. Over the last 10 years, there have been a number of filmmakers who proposed doing documentaries on Acorn as the organization sort of became more well-known as it was being attacked, frankly. And this effort originally began sort of looking at campaigns. It was called Citizen Wealth for a while, taking the name of a book I wrote in 2009. Well, that was easier to help out then. And then somehow it migrated over the last year or two to calling itself The Organizer. And this is their film, not mine. So you sort of, oh, really? Is that going to be my picture on a poster? Uh-oh. So it's a little bit of a, this is so different than the way I've spent almost 50 years in this work. But, you know, it's an organizing tool at this point, Mary Charlotte. And it's an opportunity to tell the Acorn story. So I've taken this lemon to make lemonade. I've taken whatever uncomfortability I have and said, okay, man up, Wade. Let's see if we can get people to look at why organization is important today and why we need to support low and moderate income people building the next Acorn or Acorn Again or something that responds to this terrible crisis of democracy and puts some weapons in the hands of low and moderate income people in this literal war that seems to be fought against anybody who isn't rich these days.
Lest people think that when Acorn was attacked and ceased operations in the United States as a national organization, that they stopped working, the film opens with some work that you're doing in Honduras. And I thought it was so fascinating. There you are on a hillside in Honduras where people's houses, you know, some very humble people's houses were literally bulldozed, and there was a land grab to take that land. And there you are and other organizers from Acorn, Acorn International, saying, no, we're going to win this. And I thought, well, he's pretty confident. And then by the end of the film, sorry to give it away, ladies and gentlemen, but yes, they won that.
Well, and because as we said in the film, this was their property. And that was right into Tegucigalpa, the capital city of Honduras. I mean, that just shows what impunity exists in so many places about even, I mean, the one thing that's still semi-sacrosanct in the United States is property rights, but outside of the United States, that's not even sacrosanct for most people. Those folks had lived there, and all of a sudden, their land was just being stolen. And that's, we're involved in land-grabbing campaigns and stopping that in Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Liberia, countries over there as well. Kenya, this is an issue there too. And it's incredible the impunity that the current political and economic environment has sort of given license to people to think they can get away with anything. And what's worrisome here in the United States is that that sort of message is being sent right from the top, isn't it?
Yeah. What gives you hope, and where do you see real progress being made right now?
I take inspiration whenever people are in motion. I find the women's marches encouraging. I find the discussion of so many people about starting small political groups to become active now encouraging. I think the hashtag MeToo movement or whatever it turns out to be is encouraging because it's giving new voice to people and it's giving people something that, as an organizer, I think is fundamentally important. You can't just count on the law. I mean, a law passed around sexual abuse and harassment, you know, 20 years ago, but what we'll see change now this year because of things that are happening right now dwarfs what that law could ever accomplish, and because people will be acting, people will be speaking up, people will be organizing. People won't stand for this anymore. And that kind of sense that you can embed resistance into real organizational structure. A movement alone can't make change, but if it ends up also morphing into organizational capacity and a commitment to fight rather than just hope something changes in the by and by, then the pendulum might just swing back where we need it to swing again. And that gives me hope. I mean, my view is basically if you go to work every day, if you fight every day, then you still have a chance of winning. It's when we stop fighting that we know we've lost forever.
Wade Rathke is subject of the film The Organizer. He's the founder of Acorn, and he still works with Acorn International. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
Once again, The Organizer screens on Saturday, February 10th at 11 in the morning at The Screen on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. It is part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. If you want to find out more about the film, you can go to theorganizerfilm.com. You can also find out more about Wade Rathke's work at chieforganizer.org and at acorninternational.org. And of course, SantaFeFilmFestival.com will give you the schedule for the whole rest of the film festival, which goes through Sunday, February 11th. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.